Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Filipino Freethinkers podcast. It's also a video. Today, we're doing another conversation for our cause, this time with Dan Ariely. He's a James P. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, and he's been studying human behavior for more than 20 years. Hello, Dan.
Hello, hello. I was hoping I would look younger than somebody who's studying this for 20 years.
You look great. But your best-selling books include Predictably Irrational, The Upside of Irrationality, and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. And actually, this is very relevant to our country because I don't know if you've heard, but ours is one of the most predominantly Catholic countries in the world, and also one of the most corrupt countries in the world. So later we'll talk about that. But first, I want to do something that I promised to the members of our group, because we have regular meetups. We do it twice a month. And during one of the meetups and several meetings with friends after that, I did one of the experiments that I learned from your books. So I asked people two questions. I asked them, how attractive would you rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10? And the next question was, how important is attractiveness to you when you look for a romantic partner? And it went like you said. People who said 9 would say 9 to the second question. People who would say 4 to the first question would say 4 or 5 to the second question. And I promised them that you would explain why this was. So can you talk a bit about the research that you did about this?
Yeah. So the basic question, first of all, the basic observation is that if you took all the people and you ordered the men from the most attractive to the least attractive along many dimensions, and the women from the most attractive to the least attractive, we would get what is called assortative mating. The top two people would marry, and then the next, and the next, and the next, or date, and go all the way down. Now, you can ask yourself, how do the people at the bottom live with this? Right? This is called a two-sided matching problem. Now, the person at the top has a choice of who they want to date, so they want to date the person at the top. The people at the bottom, basically, there are two ways to think about it. One way is to say that they would say every day they would wake up and say, you know, I really wanted to date a 10 or a 9, but, you know, this is what I got stuck with. And that they will basically keep on thinking that they're dissatisfied. But that's very unlikely, because people do try to find out ways to make sense of the world around them and to be happy with what they have. So the second possibility is that people somehow adapt. So we get used to it. So if you're a 3, you date a 3, but you somehow don't think of them as a 3. So how can that happen? And there are two ways that this can happen. One is that you start enjoying different sense of aesthetics. You start liking men with hairy backs or bad teeth, or, you know, people who are getting bald. That all of those are becoming more attractive for you. That's one approach. The second approach is you start paying attention to other attributes. And that's what we find happening, is that people all of a sudden say, oh, you know, beauty is not that important. I really want somebody with a sense of humor. So what happened is that the need to adapt and to make sense of the world and to be happy with what we are causes us to shift attention to things we can actually get and use them to make us happy. So that's the story.
So you mentioned this already, like a lot of people say that beauty is not that important. And there's been a trend of emphasizing other qualities. Feminists,
and by the way, I think they're right. I think they're right.
Yes.
But it's just that it's the unattractive people who hold this opinion.
just the unattractive people.
On average. And from the data, not my opinion. But, you know, if you're very attractive, and you can say, oh, they're very attractive, they're just superficial. But if you're very attractive, you value attractiveness, because that really helps you sort out the world. If you're not attractive and you can't date attractive people, you say, well, let me figure out another way to have the world in a way that makes sense to me, and I end up looking like a winner.
So that's kind of sour grapeing, isn't it?
Well, you know, the term sour grapes has a bad rap.
Yeah.
It's as if it's negative. And you know, and I think about the reason I called the second book The Upside of Irrationality is because I think that there's lots of irrational things about human nature that are just beautiful. So this is really the need for adaptation.
Yes.
And I'll give you my own life as an example. So as you know, I was badly burned many years ago. I still have all kinds of challenges and disabilities and things I can't do. And if you asked me 20-some years ago when I got injured, how happy would my life be like if I got injured this way? I thought it would be terrible. I have quite a good life, but it's really because I adapted in many, many ways. I adapted in the kind of job I picked and the kind of responsibility I have and the kind of things I can and can't do. So this human ability to adapt is irrational in the sense that we don't perceive reality in an objective way, but it's incredibly, incredibly beneficial. So I think about lots of things like that. And by the way, there are also human irrationality that are just good, like giving money to charity or volunteering your time for something else. This is something that is irrational from the standard perspective. If you go to a dinner in a restaurant that you'll never go back to, you should never tip the person. If somebody asks you for a favor from the other side of the globe, you should never do this to them if you're only worried about your outcome. So this idea that we're irrational, we need to understand that there are some mistakes, but there are some beautiful things, and then there's some really functional things. Adaptation is one of them.
So speaking again about superficiality or appearance, like there's something very interesting that I read in your latest book, where you said that people who wear fake, like designer clothes, like rip-offs of, let's say, Gucci or Prada, like we have a lot of those here in the Philippines.
The Philippines, really?
I actually live very near to one of the hubs where they sell these.
In Southeast Asia?
I kid you not.
Who would have guessed?
So we have a lot of those. And you say in your book that people who wear fakes or forgeries or stuff like this tend to cheat more. Can you explain the research behind this?
Yeah. So first of all, I let's go back to the question of does this also would happen in the Philippines or not? What are the cultural boundaries for that condition? But let's think about what happened. So as you well know, the research we're doing on dishonesty basically has the perspective that it's not about good people and bad people. Usually when we think about dishonesty, we say, oh, there's a few bad apples, let's just not hire them or put them in prison or something like that. Then, of course, there are some psychopaths out there. But what we show is that the majority of the economic activity does not come out because of few big cheaters, it comes out because of lots of little cheaters. And in our experiments, we show that a lot of people, the majority, can cheat a little and feel good about themselves. So that's the thing. And the issue is the feeling good about yourself. So think about cheating is a rationalization mechanism. That a rationalization maybe is like a little engine or a little box. And if the box gets bigger, we can rationalize more, we can cheat more and still think of ourselves as good people. If rationalization shrink, we can cheat less and we can't think of ourselves as good people if we cheat more. And everything that we found so far that changes cheating is about rationalization. So for example, the things that don't matter is how much money you tend to gain, probability of being caught and so on. The things that do matter is whether you think everybody else is doing it, nobody's getting hurt. Here is one example. Do you have illegally downloaded music or movies or software on your computer?
Is that a hypothetical question?
Somebody like you, could that person have something like that?
I think some of my friends downloaded things on here. I'm not sure if they're okay. I'm kidding, of course. I have a few files in there, one or two.
So most people have that, and if I ask my students about it, nobody's even embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
And then let's think about another activity. In the last few years, every time I go to a restaurant, I ask the waiter if there's a way to eat and escape without paying. And I said, look, I'm not going to do it. I'm just curious, you know, is there a good way to do this? And they always give me good advice. Actually, almost always. They say there's a back alley, wait for a large group. They have all kinds of tricks. And then I say, how often do people do that? I say, almost never. Now, here are two cases. In the US, if you download illegal stuff and they catch you, you can't say, oh, I forgot, I didn't pay attention. You'll get hundreds of thousands of dollars in a fine. If you eat in a restaurant, the odds of being caught is very low, and if they catch you, you can say, I just forgot. So here are two cases where we cheat in one and not in the other, and it's not about the cost-benefit analysis. It's because in the case of illegal downloads, we can say, everybody's doing it, nobody is suffering, what are we really taking? In the case of food, you consume food and you can't possibly think that nobody is suffering because of that. Now let's go back to the counterfeit. So the notion that we have is that it's all about rationalization, what you can rationalize and what you can't. But there's another important element that we call the what the hell effect. And the what the hell effect is the idea that as you start behaving badly, you start thinking about yourself in a different way. And if you're behaving badly, you say, I might as well enjoy it. So what we find is that if we people cheat in some way, then they say, oh, you know, I cheated on this thing already. What's the point? If you have some illegal download material on your computer, why not have more? What's the difference? And counterfeit stuff, fake products, basically work in the same way. If you think this is illegal and immoral, and you do it, you think of yourself as being tainted. You're not a villain, you're not a mass murderer, but you're not perfect. And now that you're not perfect, taking the next step becomes easier. So what we show in the experiment is that we can give people purses, sunglasses that are from a very well-known designer. We tell half of them that they are fake. And those people start thinking of themselves in slightly different ways, and then they're able to steal a little bit more money from us. Now, it doesn't make them, you know, steal all the way, but they're basically thinking of themselves as tainted, and the next step is easier. Now, here is the question of whether this is also applicable to the Philippines. In the Philippines, people who were fake, is it like illegal downloads where they just don't care? Do people say to other people, look at this fake bag I have? Or do they think it's somehow unauthentic and they want to pretend that it's real?
They would want it to be seen as real. I think that's the whole point of it, because otherwise they just get an original that's a local brand. So there's that implicit expectation that people would think that it's authentic.
Yeah. So in that case, then I would say it's probably going to have the same effect in the Philippines. But I know that there are some brands, like, for example, somebody sent me a picture of Adidas shoes, but the D was written as a B. So it was Abibas shoes. And those, I think, people don't, they like the design, but they make it clear to everybody this is a fake. So that one I don't think has the same effect. But if you're wearing something and you hope that other people would be fooled, and you yourself know that you're not fooled, that's where the problem lies.
I'm thinking, could this also apply to something like makeup, for example, where you put on the makeup so subtly and you expect people to not notice it at all, like as opposed to wearing makeup, like let's say lipstick, where people see it and they know that you're wearing makeup. So would someone who's wearing subtle makeup, or let's say someone who, like, how would this affect someone who has undergone plastic surgery, for instance? Because there's some deception involved in those examples as well.
Yeah, so with makeup, I don't think so. Because the issue here is not whether you're honest or not from an external perspective. The issue is whether you think of yourself as being honest or not. and I don't use much makeup, but I don't think that people who use makeup think of themselves as cheaters in the same way that somebody who is wearing a fake Armani bag is trying to convince somebody else that they have more money than they do or more stylish and so on. In terms of plastic surgery, so I think that's an interesting question. So I had lots of plastic surgeries and you know, of course I look very differently than when I looked when I got injured. And I think there's a question of which look do people think is the real self? So, you know, in my case, the surgery was attempting to get me back into how I looked before. And I think because of that, I probably don't think of it as fake. Yes. I think about it as restorative. So, for example, maybe as people get older and they want surgery, maybe if they think about the surgery as making them be their own self, who they used to be, who they are deeply inside, maybe they don't think of it. But maybe if you have something that changes you dramatically, that you're not your true self, maybe all of a sudden it changes. So that's a very interesting thought.
So
yes, by the way, is that most people would think that they're just revealing their true self.
Yes, yes.
With the plastic surgery.
If you do write a book on that, I will certainly get and read that as well. Another thing that's very common here in the Philippines, aside from makeup or downloading or piracy or, you know, buying fakes, is religion. And of course, we are a free thinkers organization and we take religion quite seriously. So would you say that religion is a predictable irrationality?
So tell me a little bit about the religion in the Philippines. So I know you're mostly Catholic.
Mostly Catholic, like some Christian denominations here as well.
But how serious are you as Catholics? Like Italians or like Brazilians?
I would say more eclectic. Not really so much fervor, or like the conservatives are a minority. Like more people are very progressive in terms of picking and choosing what they would follow and what they would avoid.
How many people go to Sunday Mass?
I don't remember the numbers on that, but there was a recent survey, but I don't exactly remember the numbers. Not as regular anymore.
Not as regular. How about confession?
Confession, less regular even. Like it's not... Yeah, the really devout ones, I guess, would do it more regularly. But the average Catholic, I think, would do like the birthdays, the special occasions, and Holy Week.
What about sex outside of marriage?
It's practiced a lot. It's
okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how the Pope will define these combinations of Catholics. So I think there's lots of very interesting things about religion. I'm actually, you know, of course, lots of religions have caused lots of misery around the world. but I think if, you know, let's forget God for a second. Let's just assume we have religion even without God. And religion is one of the oldest human institution. And they've been surviving for a long time. And from that perspective, you can go back and you can say, what is it about religion that has caused it to be so successful? And I think that as individual, religion helps us a lot to live better with each other and to think about our long term. Right? So you know, the world is tempting us to behave badly in all kinds of ways all the time. And what religion does, and I think about religion like Catholicism, Judaism, Hinduism, give you lots of rules that you need to abide by. You know, Protestant religion doesn't really give you many, many rules from that perspective. But the moment you have rules that you're going to try and follow, all of a sudden your life is more organized. There are things you do and things you don't do. And I think that's one of the powers of religion. It takes away some of your exercises of decision making and just gives you a rule. So, for example, there's one study that I really love, It's a study that looks at Orthodox Jews who are smokers and now how tempted they are to smoke on the Sabbath. So if you're an Orthodox Jew, you're not allowed to light fire, you're not allowed to smoke on the Sabbath. What do you do? It turns out they have no craving for nicotine. On a regular day, if they don't smoke, they have tremendous craving. But on that day, it's not even a possibility. It's not even a thought, and therefore temptation doesn't exist in the same way. So I think religion is really interesting. Actually, this would be considered blasphemy, but I've been thinking about the mental exercise of, if you are going to create a new religion, and you're going to create a new religion with the goal of getting people to be healthier, happier, live better with each other, and with less violence, what kind of principles from religion would you borrow? And I actually think there's lots of things from all religions that you would borrow, that those are kind of essential elements to keep us working well. And that's kind of an important issue to think about rationality and irrationality. I think that as human beings, we have a very hard time thinking about the long term, and religion helps us with that. I think as human beings, we have a very hard time forcing ourselves to have some rules. Never do this, never do this. Religion helps us with that. And then I think religion really helps us think about how to operate together in society. So here's one other example. You know, there's no commandment in the Ten Commandments against lying, right?
The bearing of false witness?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's the commandment is not about lying. The commandment is about bearing false witness.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing. Why is that the case? And, you know, I think the reason there are two reasons. One is that lying in public is very different than lying privately.
Yeah.
So if you say to your significant other, you know, honey, you look great in that dress, that's not against the Ten Commandments. But if you stand in front of lots of people and lie publicly, now you're kind of corroding the public trust and the public understanding of what's acceptable. And the second thing is that public institutions are central. So if you lie in court, you have not only lied, but you've actually reduced the value of the public institution. So if you think about it this way, religion is really trying to help us to figure out how to live with other people harmoniously. I think it's very important.
So religion does have some benefits in terms of getting people to work together. Cooperation, of course, is something that's good. But it also has some bad effects, like getting people to follow orders that are irrational, clearly, and that are harmful to a lot of people. It also keeps people from progressing in terms of legislation that can help a lot of people. Let's say using contraception is something that's very basic, or choosing who to marry or remarry, like divorce. So it's very hard to convince someone that that they're wrong when it comes to something that they believe dogmatically. And as you have said several times in your book, it's not about the information. You can present them with whatever statistics that you have about the harms and all that, but they won't change their minds. In fact, there's something called the backfire effect that makes people cling tighter to their beliefs the more facts and information that you show them. So how do you deal in cases like this when you want to convince someone who's very much tied to their beliefs?
Yeah. So, you know, we have the same problems with Republicans.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Who have very strong opinions that don't seem to be persuaded by evidence. Now, the Republican case in many ways, it's simpler because in principle, you could have some data about this. And in fact, we have all kinds of data. Religion is actually much more complex because the whole essence is that you believe it's the case and you get rewarded after you die. So the whole notion of evidence is just not absent, is not going to be present in the discussion ever. There's not a single data point that you can propose to somebody from a religion who believes that this is not the case, because you can't do it. Yesterday, my research lab and I went for a holiday party, and we went to a place that serves local hamburgers and beer. They make their own beer, they make their own everything. It's a very nice place. And I asked the students, each of them, to come up with a ritual for drinking beer, for a new ritual. And people came with all kinds of things, but one of them was based on a Dutch, I'm told, a Dutch ritual. And they say that when you toast somebody, you should look them in the eyes. And if you don't, you get 5 years of bad sex. Now, in some way, this is a little bit like religion. It's a big penalty, very hard to verify, right? If we said it's one time, you could check it out. 5 years, it's going to be very hard to measure, very hard to verify, and the penalty potentially is very large, a little bit like Pascal wagers. Do you remember that story?
Yes, yeah. Of course, yeah.
So I think convincing people about religion is not going to be easy, and I don't think it's worthwhile trying. I think the thing that is worthwhile trying is to try and shift religion to become more suitable to our environment. I think there are good things about religion, and I don't want to give them up. I would like just to think about how we get rid of the bad things and keep the good things. And, you know, it's happening too slowly in Catholicism, but I think other religions are moving a little faster.
Yes.
If you think about the Baha'i religion, if you think about Buddhism, if you think about Hinduism, there's some a more interesting dynamic religions. And then the real question about how to convince people with the information, I think we should start with simple cases like political beliefs, things that we can in principle collect data. And I'm, as a scientist, I'm a big believer in data. So my hope is that we could come to, let's say, the Republicans and say, propose to me an experiment that if it worked one way, you would keep on holding to your belief, and if you it would hold a different way, it would not. So, for example, you could say, what do we think about... I'll give an example. We did experiments in our lab in which we tax people at different rates, and we see whether increasing the marginal tax rate gets them to stop working, and we don't find any evidence for that. Now, that might not be the best experiment. It's only lab. It's not a lot of money and so on. But I would love somebody to tell me, here is what I believe. Here is the translation to an experiment. Now let's go ahead and test it. That would be a good start.
One thing that we certainly cannot get rid of, and that we would rather just make better, like you said about religion, is our government. And you said one thing that a lot of the people listening or watching this would disagree with. You said that not one country cheats by much more than another. And I'm not aware of if you've heard this, but the Philippines is one of the most corrupt countries in Southeast Asia. We have received that award several times. We're competing with Indonesia, so it's one and two between us. Yeah. So,
In the world's corruption index, where do you stand? You're not more than the countries in Africa.
No, like just in Southeast Asia, we're really bad. So the intuition would tell you that if a country is more religious, they're therefore having more rules promoting honesty and cooperation with one another, there would be less cheating and less corruption and graft. But what's the case is not only here but in other parts of the world. The places with more religions or more religiosity, higher religiosity, are more corrupt, and there's more cheating. And the Philippines is one example of that. Why do you think that's the case?
So first of all, of course, we don't know what the counterfactual is, right? You couldn't say how corrupt would the Philippines be if there was no religion. But here's the thing. I think that religion only helps in the areas where religion regulates. So if you have religious rules about specific things, you are going to be behaving better in those specific things. But there are lots of areas in which religion doesn't regulate. And religion doesn't make people overall honest. Religion just gives people recipes to behave in specific ways. So if you're a Hindu, religion gives you a specific way to wash your hands. You're going to wash your hands in those specific ways. It doesn't mean that you're going to be nicer to your kids, necessarily. Now, the thing about differences across countries, this is not a question of agreeing or disagreeing. It's a question of what the data is. So we haven't tested the Philippines, but we've tested Germany and Portugal and China and Turkey and Israel and South Colombia, South America. And we've tested some England and Canada. And so far, we don't find any difference. Oh, South Africa. So far, we don't find any difference in our task. But the thing is that our task is general and abstract, and it's not connected to a particular culture. And I think this puts us back to the beginning of our discussion, which is, you know, I think that what culture does is to take specific activities, like illegal downloads, and say, don't worry about this. Culture takes another activity, like infidelity, and say, don't worry about this. Paying your taxes, bribing a policeman. Culture does not change the moral fiber, the basic psychology of how a person does, but it changes how this psychology is getting applied in specific areas. So if I use my stereotypes about the Philippines, I guess there are some activities that you don't find them to be morally offensive. Then in other places, let's say Sweden, they would find morally offensive. But it doesn't mean that if we put you and a Swedish person in a new situation, that you will be less moral in this new situation. It's just that you have some rules for how the society behaves in that particular way. I was recently in India, and I met a head of a big organization, and he told me how when he was 16, he paid to have his driver license. Now, you're supposed to be 18, and you're not supposed to pay for it. You're supposed to actually go and take the test. But this was not an issue for him. In fact, it was a point of pride. That's how you do things, right? So now, is this person immoral in every aspect of his life? No. But in that part of his life, that's how things became.
So you mentioned a while ago that it's really the small acts that are multiplied over society that makes a big impact. But do you think that people who are given more power or more responsibility, say politicians, have a greater propensity to cheat, and when they cheat, to cheat in a big way?
So I think the answer is yes. First of all, I think that power corrupts. I think also politicians get very easily confused that they are basically public servants. They forget about this and they start thinking that they're royalty. We also treat politicians in a very kind of respectful, fearful way, right? All of a sudden, we treat them like they are not gods, but, you know, we treat them incredibly well. We pay them all kinds of respect and so on. And I think they lose the sense that they are basically working for the citizens. And, you know, I also think it's a really tough. Imagine you became, from tomorrow, everybody would start treating you differently. Everybody would listen to you very carefully. Everybody would laugh at your jokes. They would not ask you to wait in line for a restaurant. You would have a bodyguard. You could call all kinds of leaders from other parts of the world. People would want to give you gifts. How much under those conditions could you keep your thoughtfulness and modesty? Very quickly, you would say, well, I'm a different kind of a person. Clearly, those other people and me, we're just not the same. And now the question is, how would you learn the rules of the game? How would you learn what's acceptable and not acceptable? You would look at your other friends who are in the same position. And if they take gifts and bribes and do favors to their friends and start going to different parties, that would soon impact you as well. So you know, it's really easy to make fun of politicians, and we do. But I think it's a social phenomenon that we create by the way we talk about them and the way we treat them and so on. And they basically stop realizing what rules apply to them, and then as a group they shift in worse and worse directions. And this by the way, means that it's really hard to solve, but something we can solve.
So you have already hinted about this, that it's also the population or the citizens that contribute to why politicians become corrupt. It's the way we change for them, the way we treat them. And two other things contribute to why it's so difficult for, I think, here in the Philippines to change this culture. It's because of the status quo, that you keep the difficulty in changing the status quo that you have mentioned also in your books, that we are afraid of change. We think it's a scary and difficult thing. And also there's something about, you said about adaptation a while ago, that people would tend to get used to their situation. You know, they could, when they discover that there's some corruption, it could bother them for a bit, but then they return to the way they were. And that's something that people here even see as a value, as a virtue. But that works against changing the situation. So what are the other things that you think that we can do to address this?
Yeah. So, you know, there's no, the slippery slope toward deterioration, in moral deterioration, there's no increase in a slippery slope. There's no slow improvement. And I think we hear, you know, especially with Nelson Mandela's death this week, we can actually think about the South African solution, which was the Truth and Reconciliation Act. So the South Africans stood up and say, here are all the awful things we have done, and we're going to start tomorrow to be different. And I think that's actually something that every corrupt country needs to do, is to need to basically say, okay, we're starting fresh. We've done lots of things. If you think about just patching things up, if you take a system of politicians that have been used to behaving badly for a long time and you say, oh, let's patch this law, it's not going to work. You really need to have a fresh start, something like the Catholic Confession, the Jewish Day of Atonement, the Truth and Reconciliation Act, and say, we're starting fresh, we understand the values, and we're going to give it a go to be a non-corrupt, law-abiding society.
Thank you so much, Dan, for all of your time. I've learned a lot from this conversation. To everyone who's watching, I recommend that you read all of his books. They're really great. So, Dan, thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye for now.
Bye.